The scent of sawdust and varnish had filled the air in Bassett, Virginia for generations. But in 2002, John D. Bassett III found himself on a dusty road in Dalian, China, hunting for the source of suspiciously cheap bedroom furniture threatening his family's century-old manufacturing legacy. When he finally confronted Chinese businessman He Yunfeng, the Communist Party official made an astonishing proposal. Close your American factories, and I'll supply you with dressers at below-cost prices. For JB3, this wasn't just business, it was war. The third-generation furniture maker would soon launch an unprecedented battle against Chinese imports that would make him an outcast among competitors and even family members who were busy offshoring production. The book has resonated with readers seeking to understand globalization's human impact, with Barack Obama including it on his summer reading list and Tom Hanks acquiring film rights. Through JB3's story, we witness how American manufacturing transformed from locally harvested hardwoods to global supply chains, and how one determined factory man refused to surrender his workers' livelihoods without a fight. J.D. Bassett built his furniture empire through remarkable business acumen and strategic family connections. After being denied loans by his own father, he borrowed from his uncle Billy Law, vowing, "Someday I'll buy and sell you." Along with his intelligent wife Miss Pokey, who suggested manufacturing furniture rather than just selling lumber, he established the first Bassett factory beside the Smith River in 1902. The company employed 50 workers at 5 cents an hour and within 3 years was debt-free. By 1918, J.D. was shipping furniture nationwide and had set aside $1 million for each of his children. His business philosophy, which would later guide his grandson J.B. III, included maintaining cash reserves, avoiding unnecessary debt, investing in the best machinery, and addressing problems immediately. When you see a snake's head, hit it. The company's strategy of creating affordable knockoffs of high-end pieces proved immensely profitable, with designer Leo Juranek helping perfect this approach. The Bassett business empire expanded through strategic family connections. J.D. funded furniture businesses for family members and trusted managers, placing them far enough apart to prevent wage competition. When his son W.M. secretly started his own furniture company after feeling slighted, J.D. later incorporated it into the Bassett Empire under a new umbrella corporation. By 1952, 50 years after its founding, Bassett Furniture was selling $33 million in furniture annually with 3,100 employees. The company town of Bassett reflected the family's complete control. They owned not just the factories, but also the housing, electricity, police, and even the cemetery. White workers lived in small but decent homes near the river, while black workers occupied shanties in the hollow. Though paid half what white workers earned and relegated to the hottest, dirtiest jobs, black workers preferred factory work to field labor. Junior Thomas, who worked 40 years at Bassett Mirror, pouring silver nitrate and cutting glass, remained on call for Bassett family members even in retirement, noting, "I never did get weaned away from 'em." The family maintained a complex relationship with their black workers and servants. When a company doctor refused to treat black employees, Mr. J.D. threatened to fire him. Yet darker stories persisted, including C.C. Bassett fathering a child with the family maid, Julianne Barber. Their son, Clay, lived in a shack on Carver Lane, trapped between two worlds, light-skinned enough to pass for white, but never accepted into the Bassett family. As Junior Thomas succinctly observed, "We made 'em rich." John Bassett III, the youngest heir to the Bassett Furniture Empire, sought escape from his family's stifling influence. At Washington and Lee University, he displayed both shrewdness and wildness, repurposing a soda machine to sell beer at furniture-style markups while maintaining grades just good enough to avoid his father's wrath. After graduation in 1959, he joined the Army, relishing the opportunity to prove himself on merit rather than name. Stationed in Europe guarding the German border, he enjoyed the freedom from family oversight, speaking enough German to socialize, driving a Porsche, and exploring the Alps. Upon returning to Bassett Furniture, JBI found himself fighting for respect despite his name and lineage. His father positioned him next to his own CEO office in the company's new headquarters, nicknamed the Taj Mahal, making succession plans clear. Yet JBI faced resistance. His father made him trade his imported Porsche for an American Chevy, and the family strongly discouraged his relationship with a German girlfriend. Starting in quality control, JBI was perceived as cocky and insecure, making costly mistakes while struggling under his father's public criticism. The Bassett women exercised considerable influence over family matters, particularly concerning relationships and potential threats to the family fortune. They orchestrated John's meeting with Pat Von Exum, a fourth cousin and Hollins College student. After courting twice weekly for nearly a year, they married in 1963, settling near the factories, far from the wealth they would later accumulate. When Mr. Doug was diagnosed with terminal cancer, he made a shocking deathbed decision, passing over his son John for leadership, instead elevating cousin Ed to chairman and son-in-law Bob Spillman as second in command, a betrayal engineered by John's sister Jane that would ultimately forge John's fighting spirit. Bob Spillman, who proudly displayed a sign behind his desk proclaiming himself the meanest son of a bitch in the valley, ran Bassett with military precision and systematically humiliated John, making him stand while Spillman took his chair and put his feet on John's desk. In December 1982, JBI finally resigned, telling Spillman, "I might end up a failure, but I'm not going to my grave being known as J.D. Bassett's grandson or Doug Bassett's son or Bob Spillman's brother-in-law. I am not somebody else's surrogate." At the Spillman Christmas dinner, only the elderly family maid, Gracie Wade, dared speak the truth about the situation, muttering, "It ain't right," as she served the meal. John Bassett III approached turning around Von Bassett with the same persistence and cunning he used when training his hunting dogs. When he arrived in 1983, he faced a struggling company with $28 million in annual sales, $200,000 in losses, antiquated machinery, poor quality, and unpaid bills. Many retailers had dropped their line completely. Undeterred, JB3 invested $317,000 of his personal money to pay company bills, negotiated new supplier contracts, bought lumber in bulk, and loaned the company money for new machinery, eventually saddling it with $18 million in debt. Unlike the cautious Galax furniture families who lived out of the business but didn't drive the damn thing to the best it could be, John took risks. To demonstrate his commitment, John moved his desk from the offices to the center of the machine room between the rough end and finishing department. He wanted all 1,500 workers to know he was watching them, examining every number and component traversing the conveyor line. Employees were terrified of him initially, but industry insiders recognized his potential. JB3 recruited his former superintendent, Duke Taylor, a difficult but brilliant furniture maker who was fanatical about accuracy and could make furniture out of popsicle sticks if he had to and still make money. Together, they faced a factory operating only half-time with slow orders. He also brought in Linda McMillian, a brilliant but eccentric product engineer with a photographic memory. To prove Linda's worth, John and Duke initially paid her out of their own pockets until Buck Higgins relented and put her on payroll. When JB3 wanted to accelerate growth, he created a subsidiary in Sumter, South Carolina, VB/Williams. He purchased the bankrupt Williams Furniture Company for just $4 million, structuring it as a three-way venture between his family company, Von Bassett, and local Sumter investors, a strategic move to gain community support. The factory specialized in glit furniture, paper designs glued onto particle board, and became profitable within 60 days by targeting low-income consumers through retailers like Heilig Myers. John's eccentric management style combined blue-collar sensibilities with elite business acumen. Despite his wealth, he connected remarkably well with factory workers while displaying comical blind spots about everyday financial realities, once advising his plant manager to simply demand lower mortgage interest rates. His casual appearance, sweat-stained golf cap, tattered sweater vest, belied his status, though workers always knew he was boss. By the time John merged VB/Williams with Von Bassett in 1998, the Sumter plant was valued at $33 million. Meanwhile, Pat Bassett's legendary High Point market parties helped quadruple company sales to $79 million within 5 years of John's arrival. More concerning, however, was the arrival of solid wood furniture from China priced competitively with their cheapest products. By the late 1980s, the American furniture industry was changing dramatically. Larry Ma demonstrated exceptional cultural intelligence in his Asian furniture manufacturing operations, strategically organizing his multicultural workforce based on ethnicity and skills. Indians handled finishing work, Malaysians processed rough lumber, and Chinese workers performed intricate carving and veneer work. Ma became the first Asian to successfully export furniture from Asia to Middle America, beating American manufacturers with products visually identical to Bassett's but 20-30% cheaper. Ironically, American companies taught him exactly how to compete with them. By 1986, imports had caused 17 American furniture factories to close, as dining room furniture became the next category to fall to Asian competition after occasional tables. As John Bassett left Bassett Furniture for Galax, he sensed the ground shifting beneath the entire industry. If his small factory stood any chance of surviving against the coming wave of communist government-backed competitors, everything about it would have to change. Meanwhile, Bassett Furniture was experiencing internal turmoil. CEO Bob Spillman, nearing retirement and criticized for serving on numerous corporate boards while company performance declined, faced pressure from shareholders. By 1997, with the company sliding to seventh place among American manufacturers and showing no real growth since 1992, Spillman was forced to step down. His son Rob was named president and COO, but the board brought in outsider Paul Fulton, a former Sara Lee executive, as CEO, the first non-family member to hold the position. Fulton embraced a blended strategy, combining manufacturing and imports, while capitalizing on Bassett's rare brand recognition. The company recruited retail consultant Jamie Owens, who bluntly characterized Bassett's leadership as backwoods Neanderthals out of touch with their primarily female customers. The stores were reimagined with warm colors, idea coordinators instead of designers, and a female-focused approach that earned national design awards. As Bassett pivoted toward retail, manufacturing suffered. Between 1997-2000, Bassett went from operating 42 factories to just 14, with the company reporting $19.6 million in losses on $446.9 million in sales in 1997. Rob maintained that opening stores was meant to help save the factories, but the strategy alienated thousands of small dealers who'd sold Bassett for decades. In 2001, John Bassett discovered a Chinese-made Louis Philippe bedroom suite from Dalin selling wholesale for just $400, half the price of Von Bassett's comparable product. When Wyatt Bassett first saw the catalog, he initially dismissed it as an unsustainable loss leader, but the Chinese imports continued, contributing to a 121% rise in Chinese furniture imports between 2000-2002. John purchased the suite and had his engineers deconstruct it, finding different construction methods and even better quality glue than American EPA-compliant versions. Determined not to close his factory, he rallied his workers to increase productivity and suggest improvements. He implemented the Thunder and Lightning incentive program, with a cherry red Harley-Davidson motorcycle as the grand prize and a high-end Browning shotgun as runner-up. Employees who met weekly goals for attendance, production, and safety earned tokens for a year-end lottery drawing. By 2001, American furniture manufacturers were in dire straits. Von Bassett's sales had dropped nearly 10%, while competitors faced even steeper declines. Dozens of factories closed, including the J.D. Bassett factory where John had first worked as plant manager. With China joining the WTO and establishing most favored nation status, John realized the Asian invasion would become his war. John launched Von Bassett Express, VBX, an unprecedented 7-day factory-to-store delivery model to exploit China's biggest disadvantage, the 6-week shipping time across the Pacific. The program required doubling inventory from $15 million to $30 million, spending $10 million on warehouses, and completely restructuring operations. VBX succeeded in attracting retailers who couldn't afford container shipments and appreciated the reduced inventory risk. In September 2002, John sent his son Wyatt to Dalian to locate the specific factory making the cheap dresser that threatened their business. After days of searching, they found Dalian Huafeng Furniture Company in Zhuanghae near the North Korean border. The primitive factory employed 800 workers in an unheated cinder block building. More alarming was what the sales manager showed them next, a massive construction site where owner He Yun Feng was building an American furniture industrial park with capacity to ship 5,000 containers monthly. When John Bassett traveled to Dalian to meet He Yun Feng, the Communist Party official boldly revealed his plan to become the world's number one furniture maker by selling Louis Philippe bedroom suites at $100, what he called tuition price, to capture market share. Yun Feng even suggested John close all 3 Von Bassett factories and put his business entirely in Chinese hands. Back home, John immediately called his lawyer to begin planning his counterattack. With cost-cutting and celebrity endorsements failing to stem the tide of imports, John Bassett considered something unprecedented for the lifelong Republican, turning to the government for help. Trade lawyer Joe Dorn explained that under the Tariff Act of 1930, they could petition the Commerce Department to investigate Chinese factories for dumping, selling exports at artificially low prices to drive domestic producers out of business. J.B. III faced the daunting challenge of assembling a majority of the furniture industry to support his anti-dumping petition against China. This meant convincing manufacturers, many already investing heavily in Asian supply chains, to join his American Furniture Manufacturers Committee for Legal Trade. Opposition came swiftly. Retail giants formed the Furniture Retailers of America, threatening to boycott manufacturers who joined Bassett's coalition. 53 law firms lined up against them, painting coalition members as protectionists rather than job savers. By mid-2003, John had convinced 15 factory heads to join his coalition, including family-connected companies like Bassett Furniture, Stanley, Vaughn, and Hooker. But the pressure from retailers and Asian suppliers quickly caused defections. Hooker Furniture withdrew after its 5 largest customers expressed displeasure and concerns about jeopardizing relationships with Asian partners who now provided 50% of their furniture. In August 2003, with wooden bedroom imports up 54% in just the first half of the year and over 40 North Carolina furniture factories already shuttered, J.B. III gathered 450 industry colleagues in Greensboro to raise the $1.5 million needed to fund their legal battle. When one supplier worried about alienating Chinese customers, John pointed to the American flag behind the podium. "Because you're an American, that's why. Ladies and gentlemen, you were given your freedom, and you owe something to your country." For years following, J.B. III took his patriotic campaign everywhere, from Rotary clubs to congressional hearings. In testimony before the House Ways and Means Subcommittee, he memorably compared unfairly priced Chinese furniture to his hometown's illegal moonshine. Every time he testified, he was completely undeferential, Congressman Boucher recalled. He was very direct and absolutely unintimidated. When he got in front of a subcommittee, it was magic. The ITC hearing became a bitter showdown that shattered the industry's traditional good old boy camaraderie. Trade lawyer John Greenwald, representing Chinese manufacturers, accused the petitioners of fraud, playing a damning voicemail from a Lazy Boy subsidiary promising retailers Vietnamese-sourced furniture to circumvent potential duties. The opposition portrayed domestic manufacturers as hypocrites who imported furniture themselves while attacking others for doing so. Despite these attacks, Joe Dorn countered effectively, and the preliminary ruling unanimously favored the coalition, finding that domestic manufacturers had indeed been injured by dumping. Between 2001 and 2012, America lost 63,300 factories and 5 million manufacturing jobs, while China gained 14.1 new manufacturing positions. This wasn't a sudden collapse, but a slow-motion disaster that gradually faded from media attention despite persistently high unemployment rates. In Martinsville and Bassett, where the families had historically fought against economic diversification to keep wages low, unemployment remained devastatingly high. The region that once boasted 42,560 jobs now had just 24,733, with unemployment hovering between 15 and 20%. One in three families received food stamps, and three of four public school students qualified for free or reduced-rate lunches. The human toll was devastating. Former workers like Samuel Watkins went from earning $13.90 hourly to mowing lawns for $8.50 with no health coverage, maxing out credit cards for dental work. The desperation had reached such levels that thieves had stolen brass and bronze from J.D. Bassett's mausoleum and copper downspouts from mansions. As MIT professor David Autor noted, the people who argue that trade is just great for everyone, that argument is inaccurate. The bitter truth was that globalization's heaviest burden fell on America's working class. Some companies handled closures more sensitively than others. Hooker Furniture's chairman tearfully looked each worker in the eye when closing their Martinsville plant, even documenting the final shipment in a film called With These Hands. By contrast, American of Martinsville closed without warning, leaving workers to discover locked doors and lost vacation pay. For workers like Minnie Wilson and Maxine Brown, the factory closures devastated their lives and community. Wilson bounced between closing factories before finally finding part-time work handing out samples at Walmart after 3 years of unemployment. When Superior Lines burned down in 2012, former workers gathered to watch, many feeling like they were losing a friend. "It hurt like a friend passed away," said Maxine Brown. "You had worked for 30-some years with your friends in that building, and now, poof, it's gone." The settlement payment system that emerged from the anti-dumping case remained controversial. While coalition members defended settlements as the best method to ensure the worst dumpers got audited, opponents called them clever shakedowns and an extortion racket. Despite these criticisms, the ITC voted unanimously in the coalition's favor during the 2010 Sunset Review, with Joe Dorn proving that Chinese dumping continued and would injure domestic industry if the order disappeared. The anti-dumping petition had unintended consequences. It shifted massive production from China to other Asian countries, particularly Vietnam, and created a lucrative money machine for law firm King & Spalding. While it saved a handful of privately held American companies like Bassett's from closure, many critics believed public furniture companies cared only about their stock prices. Most mainstream economists criticize the anti-dumping duties as harmful to consumers, particularly the poor. Harvard's N. Gregory Menkew and Oregon's Bruce Blonigin argued that protecting archaic industries like furniture manufacturing wasn't worth the higher prices Americans paid. Gary Huffbauer calculated that each factory job saved cost $800,000 in duties. However, MIT professor David Autor offered a counterpoint, noting that while trade benefits were shallow and widespread, the disadvantages were concentrated and long-term for displaced workers. The furniture case generated an estimated $50 to $60 million in legal fees across both sides. The investment proved worthwhile. Coalition companies received $292 million in anti-dumping duties, and Chinese wooden bedroom furniture imports declined more than 70% from $1.85 billion in 2006 to $538 million by 2013. 3/4 of reviewed Chinese companies received duties higher than the initial 7.24%, confirming JB3's suspicions of widespread cheating. Von Bassett invested $23 million in new plant equipment, contributed 10% to employee profit sharing, and established a free health clinic for workers' families. The money saved approximately 700 jobs in Galax, helping preserve the town itself. It enabled Von Bassett to rise from outside the top 5 wooden bedroom furniture producers to number 1 in the country. In 2006, John Bassett tackled rising healthcare costs by creating the Von Bassett Free Clinic. For $350,000 annually, the company provided free medical care without deductibles or copays to employees and their families. The initiative dramatically reduced healthcare costs as workers received preventive care instead of expensive emergency treatments. Despite nationwide insurance increases of 12 to 20% annually, Von Bassett's $1.45 million healthcare spending remained flat. A decade after challenging Chinese imports, Von Bassett remained viable while other American furniture makers collapsed. The company had made $25 million in profits in 2012, matching what it had received in Byrd Amendment funds, with shareholder equity of $114.5 million. At 75, Bassett continued personally drumming up business across the country, believing, "There's nothing that can replace somebody with the name Bassett sitting in front of you." While economists and Chinese competitors protested, John Bassett remained resolute. "Our critics have never had to stand in front of 500 people like I have and tell them they're not going to have a job and watch women cry because they don't know what's going to happen to their families or how they're going to feed their children."